Good morning. I'm Pat Lampkin, and I'm currently the Vice President and Chief Student Affairs Officer. I think Ernie Earn had a different name last night, but I'll stick with the title I have. And I came in 1979, and I read in my email this morning that I'm moderating this panel. I had read the questions and kind of thought through and went back, and I thought when I saw Sharon Davey last night, I thought, I wonder who's moderating our panel. Well, so we've switched things up a little bit, so we're all, and it wasn't for lack of trying. I had a few other things going, but what I'm going to ask this morning is that our panel introduce themselves. You have the bios, and so they'll just make sure you know who they are and when they came and if they want to add any other little interesting piece. I will say that Phyllis Loeffler is not in the brochure, and she is very good about pitch hitting, and I think actually she may have the most context for our panel. She Jane needed to go to the women's basketball team won, and Jane is with the women's team, which is fabulous, and she also is in search of a coach. So she wrote yesterday and said that she needed to be doing other things. We will try to raise some questions on athletics, and I may have to turn to some of the folks in the audience because that has probably changed the most, and I don't want us to ignore that. So the plan will be we'll ask some questions, we'll give some context. I do hope to open it up for some questions from the audience. If you don't have any, we'll go back to some other questions. So let me turn it to Angela.
Good morning. I'm Angela M. Davis. I am currently a professor in the English department, and in student affairs, I have a joint appointment. I'm special assistant to the vice president for student affairs. I started at the university in 1975 teaching in the English department, and then went into student affairs in 78.
Is this on? Good morning, everyone. My name is Gertrude Fraser. I came to the University of Virginia as a faculty member in 1990 in the anthropology department, and currently I am the vice provost for faculty recruitment and retention.
Good morning. I'm Phyllis Loeffler. I'm the pinch hitter for today. I came to the university in 1986 and spent about 10 years as one of those association deans that will be known to many of you who sort of oversaw student progress in the College of Arts and Sciences, and then transferred over to the history department where I am now. Some of you may also know my name both because of the article that I published on Mr. Jefferson's University and the History of Women, which is on the website for this event, and also perhaps because some of you responded to a survey that we sent out in 1996 to try to capture some of the experiences of women at the university that went way back to the 1920s but carried forward up to and through the graduating class of 1976.
Thank you. So what you'll realize is that we are missing those early years, but what I will say is that we were trained by the best. Annette Gibbs, Sybil Todd, many of us have, there's been an overlap within those, but some of you, we've also had the benefit of getting to know over the years because of that tightness in those early years. But we'll do the best we can. Let me start off with, how did you find the university when you came?
In 1975, when I came on grounds, I actually came first as a graduate student from Cornell to recruit African-American or black graduate students to Cornell because I was on the graduate admissions committee. And at the time, my mentors and professors at Cornell said, well, since you're going down and you're at the stage of looking for a position, We have some colleagues that would like to interview in the English department. So I fly into Ithaca, from Ithaca into Charlottesville. Beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains. Immediately fell in love with the physical beauty of the place. And set up my table on the lawn, waiting for black students to come by so I could sign them up, give them money to go to an Ivy League school. But then I had lunch with Robert Kellogg and Ray Nelson, and I said to them, where are your black students? And they didn't answer the question. But to make a long story short, they actually started interviewing me, and here I am. Now, the other thing is, I've actually known every president at this university except three. So that puts a context. But when I came into the department, I was the only woman, forget color, was the only woman in the department. And yes, I can laugh about it now, but it was a chilly climate. I have very vivid memories of coming out of my office and the professor across the hall, and I don't even remember his name because I tend to forget. There's a phrase, Zora Neale Hurston says that women tend to remember what they want to remember and forget what they want to forget. Well, I have forgotten this guy. I'm here, and he's not. But he did not speak to me when I would come out of my office. This is no joke. This is a colleague in the department, and he would not speak to me. I never knew the motivation, but that's the reality of life in that department at that time. However, the glass was more than half full, because I was also supported by people like Robert Kellogg and the Cohens, folks in the history department like the Gastons. I mean, I was supported by friends in that became my family in the community, but it was a very different place. Now, let's turn to the classroom. In the classroom, I often found myself to be one of the few women in the classroom. I just happened to be teaching. And it was interesting. Sometimes it was combative, but always lively. So I'll stop there because that gives you a context in terms of the academic part. And when we get into administration, Pat and I can share some things.
Okay. What was the question?
I'll start at the other end next time. No.
Anyway, I'm joking. One thing about Angela that I've learned in the times that I've interacted with her, she is an amazing storyteller. The narrative is so powerful, and she just, you know, she just draws you in. And I tend to be less narratively expert. So what I will say is that when I came in the 1990s, my experience was very much framed by my department. I was in the anthropology department and also a joint with African and African American Studies. And that department was full of really interesting, eccentric, very welcoming colleagues who very much wanted me there and helped me to get situated and to start teaching and doing my research. I think the issues that were more, and so it was very positive, and I never felt an outsider. I never felt that my expertise was questioned, and I had great graduate students, great undergraduates, and I think for the first couple of years in the 90s, the real excitement for me was being in the classroom. I mean, the students were just amazing, amazingly bright, amazingly driven. And so I would come out of those classrooms, and I was like, all my nerve endings were just firing off because it had been so exciting. And I was just looking for anyone to grab to just talk about what had happened in the classroom. So I think that kind of framed my sense of this being a very positive place, even though if if I had actually looked at the percentage of women and the percentage of African-American women on the faculty, it would have been in the low 15s, 18% of the faculty. So there's a very different structural context, but the individual context is really good and enriching, and that's, I think, important to say. The other thing that began to affect me is that I adopted my daughter in 1992, and at that point, then the ways that policies could negatively impact my life as a faculty member really came to the fore, because there really weren't any policies about time off or who was going to take your classes when you're raising, you're beginning to parent this 6-week-old person. And I can remember going to my department chair, who was a wonderful, very, as I said, open person, and said, "David, you know, I'm adopting this baby. I have to start classes. What do you think I could do?" And I was very begful, apologetic perhaps. And he said, "Well, maybe you could just ask somebody to take your classes." Well, that was not a possibility, to ask somebody to take my classes for 6 weeks. So that was when I began to really understand and think about how policy can impact the lives of women faculty. And I'll talk about that some more later.
I came to the university in 1986. I came here with my husband, who was accepting a position in the history department. I had been on the faculty and chair of the department at Tennessee State University in Nashville. And initially, I came to the university with uncertainty about where my longevity here would lie. I say that because I think there are probably a lot of women like me who have had that kind of experience. Indeed, some of the people who'd been students here on the previous panel spoke about that issue of sort of coming connected to a spouse or an almost spouse. And within a year after first teaching in the history department, I joined the office of the College of Arts and Sciences as an association dean, and I've already said I spent 10 years there before moving back to the history department. I want to say that my experiences here have been primarily positive. I feel that I've really had an opportunity to do my own work, to explore parts of the university that I wanted to explore. I also want to say that in 1986, the university was a very different place than it was as the place that Angela has described when she came. In 1986, there were plenty of women students in the classroom. There were few women faculty, but enough so that one, I think, didn't really feel isolated. I feel that the university, like many universities, has a real challenge in terms of some of the policy issues that Gertrude has just started to refer to. Because there are many, many women faculty at the university who come, as I did, as spousal appointments. And I believe that there is always a kind of tension about one's sense of place. And I'm not really sure that the university has figured out quite how to deal with that.
I'll make one comment. When I came in 1979, I was in an administrative role. Many of you will remember, I always called it putting bodies in beds. I worked in housing and did the assignments. And one of the things that I learned very quickly is that there were, I think, about 6 of us at that point who did not have University of Virginia undergraduate degrees. And to admit that was not an accepted piece. And we got to know each other very quickly. In fact, I met my husband because of that very issue. So We formed a little group, and on Monday nights we would go out and have dinner together just to kind of get our own support and figure out how we interpreted the informal communication. You know, there were no names on buildings at this point. Everybody should know where to go. Everybody knew the language. And in fact, until we got a president who came from the outside, Robert O'Neill, we didn't have names on buildings. Because if you were part of the culture, you knew where to go and you knew how to do it. There was a kind of subtle communication, that there was a formal communication and an informal communication. I was coming from the Northeast at that point, but grew up in the Midwest, and I am what you see is what you get. I didn't factor in the Southern culture, that what you hear is not what is really being said. And so, so you had other layers on top of who and what you were trying to, and I was 25 years old, trying to manage an office. To be honest, many of you helped me through that. You know, Anne Brown and I raised children at the same, our first, Colleen and Meg, you know, we were pregnant at the same time, and I'll tell one more, and then I know I'm supposed to be moderating. but I prepared answers, so no. You know, Gertrude talked about adopting her child. I remember at that point I was then a assistant dean of students, or associate dean of students in Residence Live. And it was 1989, and I was pregnant with Colleen. And I remember talking to Robert Canterbury, and we all know he could not have had a better boss. But I remember him saying to me, "Well, we've never had a dean pregnant." And and I looked, you know, I didn't even think that. I looked around and I thought, well, you all have children. And then I realized, okay, there is a message here. I can tell you that for many, many years, I'll tell one more on cabinet and then we'll get into policy, that, you know, we would get babysitters at 7:30 in the morning so that I could get to a 7:30 meeting, because I was going to be the last person in the world to ever say, I need to put my child on a bus. I knew never to, I kind of learned the language of don't ever use your child as an excuse, and never even admit kind of that you have children. Not because, because I was at a point that I was trying to advance my career, and, you know, it's a competitive world. You don't want to give any excuse to do that. You know, what you see now, and then I remember as a cabinet member, looking around one day, and they were setting the 7:30 meetings, and I knew that at least one other VP had, mine were older then, but I looked and I thought, you know, she probably wants to put her child on the bus. So I said, you know, is there a reason we need to have 7:30 meetings? And I kind of looked around. I said, you know, I think maybe we have some people that might need to see their children on buses in the morning. And they're like, oh, well, we don't need to do that. Let's make it 9, you know? So I was like, well, where was I 20 years ago? But you'll see some of that change. But as Gertrude raised that in terms of where it was and where it's been, and we'll try to also get you up to speed on where we are. So let's talk about some of that change. We represent a pretty broad base. What are some of those changes we have seen from the time you came and you described that? Some of the significant things you feel over time that you'd like to talk about, both as faculty, but then I think observations of students, because that has really changed.
Well, one of the things that Pat and I were talking about earlier in terms of policy changes, and especially the way it was impacted with respect to tradition, or I should say going against tradition, is when Pat and I were in Residence Life in 1987, at that time, we still had residence halls that you could literally walk through the door. No locks. Because, why? Everybody say in unison, we have an honor system. Okay. But then there's also common sense. And because at that time, nationally, there were a lot of security issues. There was a big case in Lehigh where a young woman was actually a assaulted, raped in her residence hall. And so it didn't take us 2 seconds to have a conversation, and I'm talking about the two of us, to be quite frank about it. It didn't take us 2 seconds to say, okay, we know we have tradition, and yes, the students will be upset with this, but we have to start to secure our residence halls. We have to, from a safety point of view, morally, we just couldn't have these things happen at the university. So we actually had to go against tradition, and it was not easy. The students fought us. Not only did they fight us, not intellectually, but Pat remembers the day well. She had to actually give me the date. As I said, I tend to forget negative things, but it was the date she got, the year you got married.
I got married that weekend. I came back in the suit.
Yes. did you hear that? So we're in Dabney, and somebody walks through the front door and serves us a subpoena. And I'm saying, what is this? And what it was is that undergraduate students, I think they were second-year or third-year students, two males, one young man, very bright. He's probably a judge today somewhere. but he's figured out how to sue us pro se on his own, and they served us, the two of us, our names, not John Castine, not the Board of Visitors. Hello, lowly deans. So I won't even tell you the outcome in terms of the angst between where we started and where we ended up. But yes, we did end up keeping the residence hall secure. We actually did go downtown, but the judge said, you all go back up there and figure that out. I must tell you this, though. The funniest part, because even though they sued us, for us, they were still our students. They, you know, we understood them emotionally. That's what we did. That's what we do. But we were over in Madison Hall with the university attorney who was defending us because, to be quite frank, I said, you know what? We have done nothing wrong, and you could either have my job or we're going to countersue. I regret that a bit. But we did countersue. But while we're doing the depositions, we're there with the university attorney. Those two students on their own are sitting at the table. The stenographer's there. And what happened is the way we countersued, and I guess you're all familiar with this. They sued us because they said we were violating their freedom of speech because some of our RAs had taken down a poster where they were being derogatory about us wanting to secure the residence halls. But we didn't take down the poster, and we even informed the RAs, leave the posters there, but you know, students. So we're sitting there, and even though they're suing us for a freedom of speech, there's a clause that you can't yell fire in a crowded auditorium because that trumps that. And what we decided is because they had actually jimmied the locks and done some things to really make the dorms open, we were countersuing on that premise. Well, we're sitting there, and our attorney understands this, but the kids don't quite get it. But eventually, and one is brighter than the other, so this is how it played out. So our attorney is asking these questions, and this one young man, he's like, you know, he's like right in our face. And the other young man, who actually was the one who came up with the who did the pro se, he's starting to figure out, oh, I missed something. Oh, they really do have a countersuit. And he just went red. The three of us, our attorney, Pat and I, we excused ourselves from the room, went into the attorney's office, and fell on the floor laughing. pulled ourselves back together, went back in the room. Anyway, so, but yes, but those are the kinds of things that we had to deal with. But you talk about policy changes, and you talk about things that were really affected by having residence halls that were co-ed. That was dramatic.
So do you remember the question, Gertrude?
Actually, I do. And I think this is a good place to talk about the policies that, from the faculty side, that I think have really recognized the presence of women, both on staff and on faculty, and to also let you know that those policies have been beneficial for men as well. So that policies that recognize the full scope of humanity, you know, human capital at the university, have not been gendered to exclude men from getting the benefits of them. And that's an important thing to say. I think that's true across the board. So that, for example, we have time off the clock policies that recognize not only the time off the clock in terms of a tenure track position for faculty members. So in my case, I did not end up, you know, my child came immediately. I went to the YMCA and plopped her down so that I could go and teach the next day. Now we have time off the clock so that people can stop the tenure clock on adoption or birth, or they have a sick parent, or if they themselves are sick, and it's not specific to women, and that's on the books. We also have policies that recognize, I would say not policies, but benefits, like backup care benefits, so that people who need emergency child care or emergency care for parents that they're taking care of can avail themselves of those as well. So I would say that there's work to be done, but there's now a recognition that the people are not machines, and that they do need, policy does need to reflect the scope of their lives. The one thing that is important to recognize is that even though we have these formal policies, there is still a kind of ways in which how people use it really varies. So often, women faculty may not avail themselves of some of the policies that are available because, again, they don't want to be perceived. It's called bias avoidance. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be perceived as asking for things because they're women. So that we're finding patterns in some of the policies where men will take advantage of them, but not women. And so part of the work that we still have to do is to reduced people's sense that they're disadvantaged if they take advantage of the policies that are on the books, which seems kind of like a conundrum, but that's definitely there. One other thing that, in terms of students, is that I often notice that women students, they're caught in between, so that they have these gendered codes, the ways that they're living their lives, that's very gendered still, so that they often take on leadership roles that are much more service-driven roles, as opposed to being, let's say, the president or so on, so that they end up, just like in church, they end up doing a lot of the work as women, but they don't have the positional authority or positional roles. And that's still something, I think, to be addressed. And also, I think that also happens in the department, so that our departments are primarily chaired by men, but often women are doing a lot of the service work, whether it's for the curriculum or advising or so on. So you've got this layer, this formal layer, where women are not in positional leadership, but they're actually doing a lot of the work of departments, a lot of the work of the schools. And that's something I think we need to really be attending to.
I haven't really been involved in policy-making positions, so I can't really address how I think the policies have changed since I came in the 1980s. But maybe I could talk instead about the degree to which I see some changes in the classroom, of sort of faculty-student changes. And I think this is a perfect way, really, to pick up on what Gertrude just said, which I find absolutely fascinating. So from 1986 on, you know, the women students that I encountered in the classroom no longer saw themselves as pioneers. Many of you in this room did that work as pioneers. So by the late 1980s, you know, the student memory is incredibly short. You know, when they come in 1986, they don't know any of the history of the university that preceded them. They probably learn very little of that history in the years that they're here. And so they just make assumptions about how the university has always been. It's always been the way they see it, the way they encountered it when they came. And so by the time I came in the 1986, I think students, women students, just thought they had a right to own this place in the same way that men did. But I do think that there were and continue to be some codes, as you said, some sort of gendered codes. And in the work that I've done in terms of exploring the history of the university, one of the things that always, interested me, and it has to do with my training as a historian. I was interested in the language that gets used at the university. We are not just Mr. Jefferson's university, but we are the home of the Virginia gentleman, and the concept of honor, which is incredibly important for this university, but the concept of honor, you know, is a very aristocratic tradition that was based on certain assumptions of separate spheres of men and women, and men needing to be honorable and protect and care for women. So sort of all those, you know, historicizing terms, all that language, I think plays out in very, very subtle ways that, for the most part, people don't even see and don't even recognize. But it does play out in terms of some of the student roles that women students are willing to take on. I haven't really seen it play out in the classroom, but that might be because I am a woman in the classroom dealing with other women, so I'm not quite sure how it would play out in classrooms where there are male teachers. I do want to say that I think whether a policy change or just a change in the passage of time that I think has been unbelievably important for women students at the university is simply the growing number of women role models at the university. The growing number, which is a fundamental change from 1986 when I came, the growing number of women who are in positions of real responsibility and authority, not assistant to, not in a secondary role, but in a primary role. And I think that is fundamental. We all in our lives want to look around the world and see people who we can aspire to be like. And a lot of that does have to do with issues of identity, even though we can expand beyond that. So, you know, I would say that as we look at the changes in the university since 1986, right up to President Sullivan, you know, that is such a fundamental change for our women students and for everyone within the university system. You know, that the dean of the college is now a woman, Meredith Wu, that the head of the library, Karen Wittenborg, that we have a vice president for student affairs who's a woman. All the women on this panel, in fact, myself excluded, because I'm not in a position of administrative responsibility. I think as students look around them and see these women taking responsibility for the university, that is just so incredibly empowering and so important.
I want to address something that Gertrude said in terms of women in leadership roles. In the Residence Life program, which has been rather diverse since the 80s, it was actually one of the things that Robert Canterbury said to me when I first joined that office in 78, as my primary goal was to diversify that staff. And women, my observation is, women hit the ground running when they got here. You guys started the race, some of you, and they just kept pace. And in particular, in Residence Life, my experience has been I've had more female co-chairs of the Residence Staff Program than not. Probably have had a good percentage, it may have been maybe something like 50-50, but of female senior residents. So that's been something that's been very positive in that setting. But let me give you the reality of what some of these women leaders have had to deal with in a situation where they're the supervisor. Our resident staff members are agents of this university. They are student employees and colleagues. They are governed by the same kinds of laws of confidentiality and duty to care. So our training is intensive, and they get this. And so this is not playing at leadership. This is really being a leader. But it has been, on occasion, we actually have had to pull some of our women aside who were the co-chairs or the senior residents. I remember having conversations because I would watch the dynamic in the room, or they would come to us saying, the male RA is not really dealing with me the same way that he's dealing with the other males on staff. Or if one co-chair was a woman and one co-chair was a man, the female was having her authority challenged by her senior residents. Very similar to what I'm sure many of us experience in our roles when we supervise males or someone even perhaps who's younger. So that dynamic was taking place, and I observed it, and we had to address it. So it's a glass half full. But I'm proud to say we have always had strong leadership of females in that program. And then over the years, we started to see women take on honor chair. We have one in this room hiding in the back. But those, the women were really, they were struggling to hold their own, but they stepped up to the plate.
Gertrude, I'm going to pick on you for just a minute. You talked a little bit about some of the policies. Could you talk about some of the work that you are doing and some of the pieces? I know there were questions on numbers of faculty and some of the areas that I think you're really moving the university.
Well, my responsibility in the provost office is to pay attention to the patterns of recruitment and retention of faculty, and particularly to encourage and persuade and help to shape the diversity of the faculty. And I would say since we have gotten amazing guidance on this from the Board of Visitors, and I want to thank personally, because she has really helped to advance the work and to allow me to do my job well, to Board of Visitors member Glenn Keyes, who is here. So I want to thank her because she's a colleague in the back. Thank you, Glenn, because when I was, before I came back, I left the university for 3 years to work at the Ford Foundation as a program officer in higher education. And when I was there, the president of the Ford Foundation, who was a woman, she was very much pushing us not to consider grant-making universities that did not have a diverse board of trustees. And she actually would ask us to do a demographic analysis, the board of trustees of the universities that we were going to be doing grant making with. And it was kind of shameful. This is the early 2000s, and so I had to do that for the University of Virginia, for which I was a faculty member. And at the time, it was not a diverse board at all. And I actually came down to talk to my colleagues about this because it was very awkward for me to be advocating for grant making. And between 2000, when that happened, to 2003, there was a radical transformation of the board to have more women, more people of color on the board, and that made a huge difference because when I came back then into the position, there were board members who were saying we had to change the makeup of the faculty. We had to be more agentic in recruiting a diverse faculty. And so that was part of the chart then that I was given with the support of the leadership, including the president and the provost at the time. So we have seen dramatic changes in the diversity of the faculty in terms of African-American faculty members, a growth of about 34% or so in the percentage of faculty, African-American faculty members, about 70% for Latino faculty members. Women faculty have grown from when I started, which was in the low 20s, to about 25.7, 26% of the faculty, still very low nationally. So compared to our AAU American, research universities, we are about 52nd out of 61 AAU universities in terms of percentage of women. The highest, the universities with the most percentage of women have percentages in the mid 30% range, and we are like at 24 or so on. So there's a lot of work to do, but that actually represents a change in the past 6 or 7 years. Is there anything else? I don't know if that helps to give you a sense of where we are.
I think that's great. I want to turn to Phyllis.
Can I ask a follow-up question of this? So what interests me about those numbers is I wonder if you distinguish between tenured faculty members and general faculty members in those numbers and how that breaks down and what you see as the implications of that distinction.
So I would say that, yeah, there's structured inequality. So that, for example, the highest percentage of women faculty are assistant professors. So at the rank of professor, there are 6 men to 1 woman. At the rank of assistant professor, it's about 1 to 1. So some of this is a kind of cohort generational pattern. The other thing is that there are more women on the non-tenure track than on the tenure track. And in part, it reflects what Phyllis was saying, that still the women often come into the faculty on the non-tenure track because they are accompanying spouses or partners. And so they're teaching, but they're teaching faculty as opposed to research faculty, even though many of them are doing research. So that's what I mean by saying there's structured inequalities, so that the patterns look different depending on which collection of faculty women you're looking at. But that's something that we're very aware of, and we, in my office, we have a dual career program that tries to pay attention to this, and the Board of Visitors has allocated about $1.2 million to focus on strategic hires to help with dual career placement and to also help with strategic hires for women in underrepresented areas like in engineering, science, and technology fields. In the past year, even though we have had very low hiring because of the downturn in the economy, we have hired, with the help of those funds, we've hired 3 women in engineering at senior rank. So that's we have taken advantage of the opportunity that there's not a lot of hiring nationally to really go after some women in science and technology fields that we would otherwise probably not get. And so I think, you know, I'm proud of the university for being able to do that.
I'm going to ask Phyllis, too. She talked a little bit about the work she's done, but if you comment on what brought you to that work, and then we'll turn to questions.
I think I've commented a little bit already in some of the other remarks that I'd made, but I'd love to comment on that. In the mid-1980s, I rethought some of my interests in history, and I switched from the field of my training, which was 17th century French history, which now feels pretty distant to me, to an area of interest that was called public history. Public history in the 1980s was a very new concept for teaching, and it had to do with trying to understand how we represent the history that surrounds us, how we make the decisions about what we're going to display in museums, in historic houses, in national parks, etc. You know, what drives those decisions about how we represent the history as a form of creating national identity, local identity, regional identity, etc. So that has been my area of research interest really since the mid-1980s, even before I came to UVA. And when I came to UVA, I initially actually taught French history for a year before joining the dean's office. And then when I joined the dean's office, I had the opportunity to continue to teach on a more restricted basis. And I said, well, you know, I'd really like to pursue this interest. I was at that point finishing a book in the area of public history, and I thought, well, you know, I should carve out a little bit of a niche of interest. I started to look around, and I thought, whoa, what a playground this is here. You know, you have Monticello, you have the University of Virginia, you have Montpelier, which at that point really wasn't open to the public, but you have Ashland. I mean, you know, you have all these presidents who came from Virginia. So it was really an amazing playground. And so I guess the first thing I did is say, well, let's look at this university. It's a public place. It gives tours. Students give tours. Lots of people come from outside. It's an absolutely magnificent edifice. You know, how is this place being represented? So, you know, I quietly took a few little tours to sort of try to see what people were saying about the university. And I heard all this lore, and I started to think, well, is this true, or is this just folklore? And how do we get to the bottom of it? And then after a little while, I actually started teaching a course on the history of the university. But I decided I didn't want to teach a course on the history of the university in the 19th century, because I felt that history encompasses us. That's all around us. We sort of repeat that all the time in all of this language that we use and in some of the iconography that surrounds us. What I really wanted to do was to understand how the university evolved from those 19th century roots to what it had become by the 1980s. And so that kind of started my journey. And one of the things that I sort of quickly learned is that over and over and over again, people said, well, when women came in 1970, and I thought, because I had already looked at some of the materials in the archives, and I knew that the Board of Visitors had approved that women would come in 1920, you know? I mean, the president of the university regularly said that when women came in 1970. And so I sort of thought, well, what's this about? You know, how do we come to understand, one, why that is the memory, and two, what the real story was? And then that led me to the research that I did. We sent out, some of you may remember that in 1995, there was a 100th anniversary commemoration of the Rotunda Fire, something I always thought was pretty odd that you would commemorate a disastrous fire. But we did. We commemorated the 100th anniversary of the Rotunda Fire. And, you know, it was an opportunity to collect the impressions of people going way back who had memories of the lawn. Okay, and the Alumni Association actually oversaw that. And so all of a sudden, there was this information about wonderful recollections of the university from people from the 1920s on. But who lived on the lawn? Who lived on the lawn, at least up until 1972, you know? It was men who lived on the lawn. So we had all these recollections of men who got to live on the lawn. And as a follow-up to that 100th anniversary of the Rotunda Fire, I was on a committee. At that point, I was actually on a fellowship in the president's office for a year, and so I got to be on this committee, and a group of people said, well, you know, this was such a wonderful project, this recollections of people who lived on the lawn, we ought to expand our survey. So that then led me to this survey that I got involved in with the support of the university in 1996, in which we sent out these questionnaires to all the women whose names we could find. The Alumni Association was enormously helpful. If you were on the Alumni Association list, you probably got this 7-page survey in the mail with a cover letter from John Castine. Maybe you ignored it. So but I think it's not too late. What I'd really like to suggest is that we, and I'm quite serious about this, is we have such marvelous comments, and I know through this meeting there are opportunities for people to offer their own comments, but there might really be a way to sort of expand that survey to new generations of women and to continue to kind of collect these views so that we will have a more appropriate record of all this.
Thank you. I think we have time for maybe one or two questions if anyone has a question before we head to lunch. Kate?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to need to get some help, but I did talk. Oh, okay. I will give you one bit that Annette Gibbs told me last night. She said that we did not have until 2 years in, I guess, any club sports or intramurals, and we were so successful in club sports that varsity sports. 1 year. That's right. 1971, we began club sports and intramurals. 1973, I think it was, we began varsity. And we had three varsity sports? Okay. So let's turn it over. We've got some folks here who can answer better than I can. Who wants to, or just stand up and talk loudly? We've got a couple of folks that can give us some history, it sounds like.
In 75, when I arrived at Virginia, there was no women's track team. We formed a women's track club that year. It was not until 2 years later that we became a recognized women's varsity sport. At that point, we did not have a coach. The men coached us. We worked with Coach Lou Honesty, who was terrific, if any of you were involved in athletics here. I was coached by my fellow male teammates for my first 2 years on the team. We also did not have women's equipment. I was a thrower. I did javelin, shot put, and discus, and we used the men's equipment until we competed in other schools where we were then allowed to throw with women's equipment. And if any of you have ever done field events, men's equipment weighs about 3 to 5 pounds more per item than women's equipment does. So actually it was to our advantage to practice with men. And it was a rarity for us. Now I'm proud to say we have not only a nationally recognized track program, but a very highly ranked throwing program.
Hi, my name is Lynn Petty Wales, and I came from a small school in Baltimore, and I believe that the reason I came to Virginia was because I played field hockey, basketball, and lacrosse. So I jumped in with 2 feet, and this was in 74. And there are, actually, could people who were involved in those early 70s when we were between club and and Varsity Stand Up.
Oh my God.
All right.
We were the beginning of Virginia sports, and I feel my alignment to the school is athletics has been a big part of my existence. But the things that we had to do and the things that happened as we, you know, came along, and I did field hockey and lacrosse for 2 years before I transferred into the nursing school. And then it just didn't become possible to run wind sprints and then be in the hospital by 5:30 in the morning, plus our travel schedule. But it was the beginning, and Deb Ryan is getting ready to retire, but she came in 75, and she was the assistant coach for field hockey. And she had graduated from her sinus, and she was a wonderful teacher and coach and mentor in all sports that she had anything to do with. So we were here at the beginning, and it was very interesting. It was interesting because of how the men treated us. The coaches, they weren't really happy with having us in University Hall and sharing the equipment. But we were extremely successful. 2 years into the lacrosse program, we won the Virginia State Tournament, whatever that meant at that point in time. and that's what I remember. But it was the beginning.
Thank you. I think a name that kind of led the women's athletic program at that point was Barbara Kelly. She was the first person appointed, and she really brought it all the way through. And Jay Miller, who started out coaching and now is in as senior associate, so she would absolutely be able to tell us. And as you know, that Deb Ryan will be stepping down, and she represents 35 years of she has seen it from the beginning, and she tells stories. And I live these stories at another institution, much smaller, of driving yourselves to the games, finding your own equipment, and sometimes coaching, playing, and almost refereeing. But it has come. It's probably been the most significant change when I look at raising a daughter and what they are exposed to, and watching young boys go to women's games and see them out on the field is just tremendous, because that's how they're raised. And that, in at least some of our times, has, I think, been the major. If you have not been to any of our women's sports, men's too, but, I mean, they are top-notch. You need to take the time and get over and see them. And, you know, field hockey and lacrosse are just today, 1 o'clock lacrosse. One final comment, and we're at 11:44. Stand up, and if you can, maybe Wayne can get that.
If you look on the website for this weekend, you'll see a Cavalier Daily story about early women's sports, which I wrote. I'm Holly Smith from the class of 72, and I can remember trying to go practice on the basketball courts, and we just got pushed off. I just said, go away. it was hard to fight just to even get the space, and I thought, why am I paying my $20 athletics fee if I can't even use the facilities? So in the story I wrote for the Cavalier Daily, I can't quote it exactly, but I can say you'll see it on the website. But I remember, I think it was Ms. Kelly saying, well, we're not going to encourage women's sports that much because we want women to cooperate, not be competitive. And they said there were no plans to have any athletic scholarships for women. So that's where it stood in 1971.
Thank you. We don't want to be late for lunch, and we'll see you over there.
How's it going?
You all look great.
Thank you.
Hi, Wayne.